even outside the assembly, that God's word will be faithfully presented and his truth clearly expressed. We're studying, as has been announced, the Sermon on the Mount. One of the truly great portions of Scripture, though all Scripture is great, that we find in the whole New Testament. I have been inclined to call it the Constitution of the Kingdom. The Bible doesn't call it that, but it's very clearly a matter of discussing the Kingdom of Heaven. The term Kingdom of Heaven appears 8 times in the sermon. In the very beginning, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the Kingdom of Heaven. And in the near conclusion, he says, not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the Kingdom of Heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. And sprinkled all through the sermon are references to the Kingdom. Jesus had been preaching in Galilee concerning the Kingdom. If you look back in the latter part of the 4th chapter of Matthew, and incidentally our study will be directed to the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of Matthew, though I think there's a lot of parallel teaching, whether it's the same occasion or not, in Luke. But we're going to look at the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of the book of Matthew. Now, in the 4th chapter, beginning in verse 23, Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues. I think when we think of Jesus preaching, we tend to think of him more as teaching outside, maybe in a boat or out in the field. But he taught in synagogues in those early days before he was excluded, and he was teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom. And I just rather suspect that this is a sample sermon that Jesus preached when he preached the gospel or the good news of the kingdom of heaven. So he is here referring to the kingdom and telling us what the king alone would know and what would most certainly be authoritative as word of the kingdom, because the king is the one who is speaking. And he begins his sermon with a description of kingdom citizens. Now, the Jews had been anticipating the kingdom, thinking of it primarily as an extension of the Old Testament kingdom, or a renewal of that Old Testament kingdom. No king had sat on the throne since the time of the Babylonian captivity, and they were looking forward to the renewing of the ancient kingdom. And if you had asked them to describe a citizen of this kingdom, which had been promised by Daniel, as well as others of the prophets, I suspect they would have started to say, well, a citizen of the kingdom will surely be a physical descendant of Abraham. And they would expect that he would be a very, very wealthy, prosperous person, because this was part of their expectation of the kingdom. They would expect him to be very honorable and greatly honored by the people of the world, because one of the things they anticipated was that the Gentiles would come and worship at the feet of the Jewish people when this great kingdom was established and when the Messiah had come. Now, if that's what they expected, they must indeed have been surprised when Jesus began his description of the kingdom and the citizens of the kingdom, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who are hungry and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted. Persecuted? In the kingdom? When the kingdom comes, persecuted? Yes. Blessed are those that have been persecuted for righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So these beatitudes, as we call them, or these blesseds, begin and end with the kingdom of heaven, a promise of the kingdom. That's significant, and it's something we must understand from the very beginning that the kind of citizens the Lord anticipates in his kingdom are poor in spirit, mournful, meek, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, pure in heart, peacemakers, and persecuted. The word blessed here probably means something that we have not understood. It's been often said that the word means happy. Now, it doesn't mean giddy. It doesn't mean joking and laughing all the time. That's not the point. But the point is that this is the person who's truly considered successful. That this is the person who's to be congratulated because he's poor in spirit, mournful, meek, and the like. Now, how shall we discuss each one of these? I've wrestled with that question. What is the best way to define, to describe people who are poor in spirit and mournful and meek? One of the interesting things about the Bible is that it doesn't just deal with words. It deals with flesh and blood. It deals with people. And Jesus did much of his teaching by talking about people. And it just occurred to me that maybe the best way to describe these qualities would be to think about people in the Bible who were outstanding in possession of these qualities. When you think of someone who is poor in spirit, who do you think of? It would be very interesting to hand out some cards here and let different ones of you supply your suggestion of an example of those who are poor in spirit. But I'm going to give you my suggestion, and if you have a better one, you might just mention it to me after the service is over. But when I think of someone who is poor in spirit, I think of Cornelius. Now that may seem just a little strange, because Cornelius was a rather powerful person. He was the centurion in the Roman army, which was an occupying army in the land. And I suppose a centurion would be the equivalent of a captain, but he was in a very special group. This group was the Italian band. It wasn't made up of mercenaries, as some might be, but these were pure Italians. And he was a man of great wealth, apparently, because he had servants and apparently a large home in which to live. So he was a very prominent person, but he was poor in spirit. And that just brings to our attention the fact that Jesus is not talking about how much money somebody may have in the bank. He's not talking about the kind of job the person has. He's talking about a person who is poor in spirit. And Cornelius had already demonstrated this. Even though he was a man of great in power and great influence, he had given alms to the Jewish people, the people that were under him and under the army that in which he was a captain. Not only that, but he was a man who recognized the true God and prayed to God, apparently at the hours of prayer that the Jews maintained. And in addition to this, he was a man who was seeking truth, seeking to know what was right. And when the Lord told him where to find a preacher who would tell him words whereby he could be saved, he sent immediately for the preacher. And when the preacher came in, this centurion, this man so prominent, fell down on his face before this Jew who was inferior to him from a human, worldly point of view completely. But he recognized him as God's messenger. And if he was God's messenger, then he was to be honored. Of course, Peter said, "Stand up, I myself also am a man." Peter understood that he himself was not to be honored, not to be worshipped. But this man was of that disposition and attitude, that humility. And when he learned what to do, he immediately was obedient. There was no hesitation. Now, that's what I believe is... It's typical of one who is poor in spirit. He wasn't haughty. He wasn't proud. He wasn't in any way cold toward obedience to the truth of God. He was poor in spirit. Well, who do you think of when you think of someone that's mournful? I might surprise you with this suggestion, and that's Peter. Now, Peter wasn't somebody who went around crying all the time, and I don't think that's what Jesus intended. I believe that Christians should be joyful people. And one of the interesting things you read about in the first part of the second chapter of Acts and on through, that these Christians were joyful, with gladness of heart, we're told over and over. And when they obeyed the Lord, they did so joyfully. But the point here is that a person is tender-hearted so that he can be compassionate, he can be touched with the needs of others, and especially can be touched with his own sins. Now, Peter, you remember, denied his Lord. But when he realized what he had done, do you remember what he did? He went out and wept bitterly. And that's the kind of person Jesus is talking about. I say again, not a person who goes around crying all the time, but a person who's tender-hearted, a person who has a conscience, a person who can be touched and can weep for his sins. I don't see a lot of that these days. Too often there's a desire to defend ourselves in our sin, to excuse our sin. But Peter went out and wept bitterly. And I believe that's what Jesus is talking about when he talks about a person who is mournful. For they shall be comforted. Wasn't Peter comforted as the Lord allowed him to confess him three times and then gave him the responsibility of announcing the gospel not only to the Jews first, but also to the Gentiles? And what about someone weak, meek, rather, is the word I wanted to make. I got ahead of myself there just a little bit. You might tend to think about, well, who can we find as wishy-washy and weak? Well, you wouldn't think of Stephen. Oh, he was a powerful man. He was a powerful debater. He was such a powerful debater that when the people in the synagogue tried to answer his argument, they couldn't answer him. They got so angry with him that they hauled him before the court, and when he finished his speech, instead of giving some kind of a formal condemnation and sentence, they dragged him out and began pummeling him with rocks, with stones. And what did he do? He shouted back, "You big sire of this! God, bring down fire from heaven on it!" No. "Lord, lay not this sin to their charge." Christ-like, completely. Meek. And who would you think of as someone hungry and thirsty for righteousness? Now, there are a number of people you might mention there, but I'm going to think about the Ethiopian for just a moment. Here was a man who also was a very prominent man, the treasurer of Queen Candace in Ethiopia. But he was eager enough to be right that he had made at least a 600-mile trip in an old chariot. I didn't even come 600 miles in a minivan, and it can be tiring. But he went 600 miles in a chariot to Jerusalem to worship. And I don't know where he got his copy of Isaiah. Those books like that, well, they weren't books, they were scrolls, were handwritten and extremely expensive. Nobody would have a full copy of the Old Testament. But somehow he had come into possession of a copy of Isaiah, possibly bought it in Jerusalem. And he couldn't wait to get home, but you can just imagine him jogging along, reading this thing, trying to, not only reading it, but trying to understand it. And when an evangelist comes along to the side of him and says, "You understand what you're reading?" He said, "How can I, except someone should guide me?" And when the evangelist gets up into the chariot with him, he is puzzled. And if you just read that section for the first time, starting in the 52nd chapter and reading into the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, which is what he was reading, he didn't know he was changing chapters, by the way. That's something that came on later. You're just reading down through there, and you read about someone that's high and lifted up and exalted, and then you start reading, "He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid our face from him." And then he gets on down there and says, "His life is taken from the earth." Who in the world could this be, he's wondering. Was it the prophet? Well, it doesn't sound like the prophet. That's not anything that happened to Isaiah. Well, could it be the Messiah? Sometimes that was the interpretive approach. That if it's not the... Well, no, this couldn't be the Messiah. Despised and rejected of men. This man of sorrow, acquainted with grief. Is life taken from the earth? Oh, who is this? Well, the preacher just immediately began preaching to him Jesus. Of course, that's who the prophecy is about. It was about Jesus. And as soon as he learned about Jesus, and even learned what Jesus wanted him to do, before he even got to the next town, he saw water and said, "Here's water. What hindered me from being baptized?" Why? He wanted to be right. He wanted to be right. And as soon as he learned what was right, he was ready to do it. He wasn't worried about what it was going to be when he got back to Ethiopia or what the Jews in Jerusalem. It didn't make any difference. He saw what was right, and he wanted to do it regardless of the cost. And that's what it means to be hungry and thirsty for righteousness. Hunger and thirst are the strongest desires we have. Some people think it's otherwise. But people will go to extremes because they are hungry and thirsty, to which they would not go to satisfy any other appetite or desire. It's strong. But here is someone who is hungry and thirsty for righteousness. Now, what about someone merciful? When I think of mercy, I think of Barnabas. Barnabas is one of my favorite characters. I've loved preaching about Barnabas and thinking about Barnabas and trying to imagine what Barnabas would be like if I could know him personally. We know him as the son of encouragement. That's the meaning of the word, or son of exhortation, the word Barnabas. It was kind of a nickname, really. That wasn't his name originally, but that's the name the brethren gave to him. And in every picture we have of Barnabas, he is demonstrating a concern for other people, a desire to help people who need help. The first thing we read about him is selling his property to get funds to help the poor in Jerusalem. And then the next thing you know, here has come a man who was a persecutor, Saul of Tarsus, and he comes to Jerusalem, and nobody wants to have anything to do. Barnabas reaches out for him. He's a man that's down, and Barnabas is not going to kick a man that's down. He's going to help him to get up and help him to be received. And then when the church is needing some help, that he goes and gets Saul and brings him there to Antioch. But even before that, here's a group of Gentile converts up in Antioch. And if you'd sent the wrong Jew up there, it could have been a disastrous to the relationship between Jews and Gentiles. But they knew their man, and they sent Barnabas. And when he saw that the Gentiles had received the gospel, he was glad. That's the kind of man he was. He was concerned for those who needed help. And then you remember just a little bit later when there was a need in Jerusalem that he and Saul carried the funds back to Jerusalem, Judea, to the poor who were in the churches of Judea. And then a little bit later when there's a gospel to go out into the world, he's the one that goes, not knowing where he's going, not knowing what it's going to cost. But there are lost people out there that need the gospel, and he goes with Saul to preach to them. But when they get ready for a second journey, Saul said, "We're not going to take your nephew Barnabas, or Mark. We're not going to take Mark." "Yes, we are." "No, we're not." "Yes, we are. We're not going to leave this boy here. This boy needs encouragement. This boy needs somebody to stand by him. And I'm going to stand by him." And Saul said, "Well, if you're going to stand and take him, I'm not going." He said, "Well, if you're not going to take him, I'm not going with you." And so they go separate ways. It's one of those things I almost wish I didn't see in the Bible. And yet I'm glad I do. Because I learned that good people can disagree, and good people can have differences, and maybe even to the point that they can't work together. But separately, they can do the Lord's work and respect one another and encourage one another. And Paul continues to write about Barnabas with respect and honor. And that young man that Barnabas stands by is the very one Paul wants when he gets ready to die to come because he's useful. Barnabas was a man who had compassion, concern for other people. And what about somebody pure in heart? Well, you can just almost, you just think all the Christians. But the term pure in heart here may very well suggest a single-mindedness. A single-mindedness that will not allow anything to interfere. A pure purpose, a pure goal, seeing Christ and being what Christ would have him to be and not being distracted by anything. And if that's the case, I'd have to suggest Paul the Apostle. Here was a man who had been a prominent Jew, but he said, "Those things that were meaningful to me now are nothing, that I may gain Christ and be found in him. And not having my own righteousness, which is of the law, but the righteousness which is from God by faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and be conformed into his death." Jesus meant everything so that he could say, it is no longer I that live, but Christ lives in me. A man who had no other goal than to please the Lord. I think you know enough about Paul that I don't really need to elaborate on that at all. And who would you suggest as a peacemaker? There's some peacemakers in the New Testament, but I just kept on being brought back to one in the Old Testament, and that's Abraham. You remember God called him out of Ur of the Chaldees, and he brought his, that's Iraq, incidentally. God called him out of Iraq, so you know where that is, and sent him over to Palestine, to Israel. But anyway, to what's now Israel. But he took with him his nephew Lot. And they got over there into the promised land, and both of them prospered to the point that there just wasn't enough land for the two of them. Their herds and flocks were just filling the country. So what did Abraham do? Say, Lot, this is my expedition here, and I just was good enough to bring you along, but it's just not enough room here for us. You're going to have to move on somewhere. Not Abraham. You know the story. He takes him to where he can see the well-watered plains of the Jordan and also that old hill country of Judea. He says, Lot, take your choice. Whichever one you choose, I'll go the other way. Peace. Peace. And not only was he a peacemaker with men, but one of the ideas here of being a peacemaker may be an idea of making peace between men and God. And Abraham was that. You remember the Lord said, I'm going to destroy Sodom? Oh, Lord. If we can find 50 men there, would you spare the city? Yeah, I'd spare it for 50. I know the Lord said, yeah, I doubt he did. But yes, I'd spare the city. I don't want to get too colloquial with the Lord here. But if it fails of 5, if there's just 45, would you? Yes, I'd spare it for 45. Well, Lord, I hate to just keep on. I'll get colloquial with Abraham here. I hate to just keep on with this, but if it's just 30, would you? Yes, I'd say. Well, let me just say one more. What about 20? Yes, I'd save it for 20. Lord, don't be impatient with me. But he must have been thinking about Sodom and how wicked it was. And he said, how about 10? Yes, I'd save it for 10. Are we that concerned about a city that's lost? About people that are wicked? Abraham was. And he wanted to try to make peace between Sodom and God, if you please. It'd have to be, of course, by changing Sodom, but that was what he hoped for, I suspect, if God would just spare it. Abraham was a peacemaker. But finally, what about those who are persecuted? Where would you start with that? I suggested John out there on the Isle of Patmos. Persecuted for so many, many more years, perhaps, than most of the apostles. James died, his brother, died all very, very early. And Peter was arrested, and they thought he was going to be killed, and later was, and Paul was. And as far as we know, all the apostles were persecuted and died. Persecuted for righteousness' sake. There's some interesting things to be said about that. One is that these qualities are not commands. Did you notice Jesus didn't say, now you be pure in heart? Jesus didn't say, now you be poor in spirit. Jesus didn't say, now you hunger and thirst after righteousness. These are just characteristics. He said, blessed are the poor. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness. They'll be filled. These are not commands. They're simply telling us the kind of people that will make up the kingdom. And if people are not of this disposition, they're probably not even going to get in the kingdom in the first place. That probably was the problem with Nicodemus. I don't know whether he ever got in the kingdom. I hope he did. I hope there was a change. But he was so proud of his descendants from Abraham that when the Lord said, you must be born again, he didn't say it, but what I suspect he thought, well, what's wrong with my first birth? It's the most honorable, most significant, even spiritually, of any birth that anybody could have ever experienced. The idea of his needing to be born again, it just didn't get through. He just didn't get it, as we say sometimes these days. And I think one of the reasons was his pride. He wasn't poor enough in spirit, though he was a good man. Perhaps not hungry and thirsty enough for righteousness. At this point, at least, he wasn't ready for the kingdom. These are qualities that must be possessed if a person is even to enter the kingdom in the first place. And certainly if he's to grow in his relationship with the king. These provide us with a test of our own citizenship in the kingdom of heaven. To what extent am I truly poor in spirit, mournful, meek, hungry and thirsty for righteousness? All of these qualities that Jesus says are characteristics of the kingdom of heaven. Nicodemus thought he was ready, but he wasn't, because he lacked these qualities. And we may think we're ready. In fact, a lot of people just think they are really, really important in the kingdom of heaven who are not even in it. And one of the reasons is they lack these special qualities that must exist if one is to be accepted. These are facets of the same character. I'm sorry we can't all see all of this, but I'll tell you what's there anyway. These are facets of the same character. Jesus is not saying, now the poor in spirit can get into heaven, and if somebody else is not poor in spirit, but he's mournful, he can get in. And if somebody may be poor in their spirit or mournful, but if he hungers and thirsts after, he can get in. That's not it. These are all actually facets of the same character, the same person. One who's a true citizen of the kingdom is all of these things. Every one of them. It's like a gem or a jewel. You look at it from different directions. You may see different colors, and you may see different shapes, like a diamond, well cut. You see different ways you look at it. It looks different. But it's the same jewel, and it's the same person, the same personality. You look at him one way, and you see emphasize his meekness. You look at him another way, and you see emphasize his peacemaking. You look at another way and you see his poverty of spirit. All one character. Well, there are objections that people raise when we explain these things. They'll say, well, I just can't imagine a person with all of these qualities. I'm not sure that I could come up with a single character who possessed all of these qualities to the ultimate. What we've been doing is speaking about characters who were outstanding in this quality or that quality or another quality. I can't think of anybody else but one, and that's Jesus. And he had every one of these qualities in perfect balance. Jesus was poor in spirit. You know that statement he made, I am lowly in heart? Well, you could really translate, I am humble in heart. Jesus was humble in heart. He was poor in spirit. His very choice of a birthplace. Jesus is the only person that was ever born in the world who chose where he was going to be born. And where did he choose? I don't have to tell you. He's the only person that could have chosen his parents. And whom did he choose? He's the only one that could have determined where the announcement of his birth would be made. And to whom was it made? Humble circumstances, humble people, no pride at all in Jesus. Poor in spirit. And mournful in the sense that we have discussed it. You remember that passage that so many people used to know? John 11:35, I don't know whether a lot of folks, but when I was a boy, you know, you'd go by in the Bible class and you'd say, I want everybody here now to quote a verse, everybody here. And about half the little boys would say, Jesus wept, John 11:35, shortest verse in the Bible. Everybody knew that one. I don't know whether anybody knows it, but Jesus did. And that's not something just to memorize. It's a significant thing. And one of the things about it is that he knew it wasn't just the death of his friend or the fact that he'd come to the grave of his friend. He knew that within just a very short time, that friend was going to be back in his embrace. Why did he weep? He saw Mary and Martha weeping. His friends were weeping. And he had compassion. Again and again, it said that he looked about on the multitude with compassion, compassion, suffering with, weeping with those that wept over Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. And do you remember when he was actually on the way to the cross and some were sympathizing with him? He said, don't weep for me. Weep for yourselves. You're the ones that have the terrible experiences coming. Jesus was able to mourn. Jesus, in fact, some say he's Jeremiah. Jeremiah was the weeping prophet. And he was thought by some to be Jeremiah returned. And what about meekness? Well, we quoted that passage a minute ago in which he said, I'm lowly in heart. That's the last part of it. But he said, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. And in that passage that we quote so often from 1 Peter, the second chapter, beginning verse 22, we should follow in his steps who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. Sometimes we stop there, and it's all right to stop there. It establishes the fact that Jesus was without sin. But keep reading, keep reading. Who, when he was reviled, that is when people said harsh, ugly, mean things to him while he was on the cross and even throughout his lifetime, calling him a fornicator, I think, in one case, or at least saying he was born of fornication. In another case, speaking of as a glutton and a wine bibber and all kinds of terrible things they said. But when he was reviled, he reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not. Meekness is strength under control. And Jesus had the strength, the power, that he could have wiped them out with his breath. But when he was reviled, he reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but delivered himself to him that judges righteously. Could you say that Jesus was hungry and thirsty for righteousness? When he came to John the baptizer, and John said, you don't need to be baptized by me. You ought to be baptizing me. What did Jesus say? Suffered to be so now, for it becomes us to fulfill all righteousness. Jesus came to do right, and he never did wrong. That's how hungry and thirsty he was for righteousness, that he never, never did wrong under any set of circumstances. And he could say in John 6:38, I've come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him that sent me. He came from heaven to do God's will, because all his commandments are righteousness. Well, what about mercy? Oh, where would you find another example of mercy that could compare to Jesus? Again and again, as we know through his lifetime, he extended mercy. Mercy, I should say, just a word of definition perhaps, is looking at someone who is helpless, someone who needs something, and being concerned for him, being compassionate, and reaching out to help. And that's what Jesus did. Blind people. I thought about that lame man. When the apostles saw him, they said, who sinned? This man or his parents? They saw him as an object of sin. And Jesus had compassion on him and healed him. The Pharisees called him a beggar. Jesus saw him as a soul that needed help and helped him. And this was true of so many that Jesus encountered during his lifetime. But it's true of Jesus toward me. I needed help. And there's a song we sing sometime that he saw me in deep despair and flew to my relief. And that's exactly what he did. I was among those he foresaw that were lost in sin, for whom there was no hope except for some divine intervention. And he came. He came. Took my form, lived in poverty, persecuted to a degree that I've never been persecuted, so he could extend his mercy to me. Jesus is the example of mercy. And pure in heart, Jesus never lost sight of the purpose of his coming. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day, for the night comes when no man can work. Jesus had his goal constantly to please God. And if we want to be like Jesus, 1 John 3:3 says, he that has this hope purifies himself as he is pure. He's the standard of purity. And what about a peacemaker? Well, again, we could read the whole second chapter of Ephesians, a beautiful thought, which first describes the separation between God and, well, the God and the Jew, and then God and the Gentile, and then Jews from Gentiles. Separation all over the place. Jesus came to make Jew and Gentile one and reconcile them both in one body unto God. The ultimate peacemaker, Jesus was. And what about the one who persecuted? Again, Jesus. Jesus, no one perhaps has ever suffered what Jesus suffered. Well, one of the things that makes suffering difficult is when you've known something better. So when somebody lives in an old shack, I go by and I think, oh, what a terrible place for a person. But that person lived there all his life. He doesn't know any better. And he doesn't feel sorry for himself. I know there's some people I'm sure feel sorry for me where I live because they've lived in such splendor. They've lived with such greater luxury and so on. They look at me and they... But it doesn't bother me. I feel perfectly comfortable because, well, I just didn't expect anything any better. Look what Jesus had had. And then he comes to be born in a stable and to never have a place to call his home. Birds have their nest, the foxes have their hold, but the Son of Man has not where to lay his head. And despised and rejected of men, man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, misunderstood, and finally put to death, persecuted. That's the King. That's the King. And if you want to be great in a kingdom, you have to be on good terms with the King. And to be as much like the King in your thinking. If you get crossed up with the King because you think one thing and he thinks something else and you let him know it, you're in trouble. But the more you think like the King and the more you act like the King, he's going to respect you. He's going to appreciate you. He's going to raise you and raise you and raise you. And that's true in the kingdom of heaven. It's true in the kingdom. That's the reason when James and John came to Jesus and their mother, wanting him to appoint them to some great, he said, no, it's not for me to do. I can't appoint you to be great. You'll be great by what you are and by what you become. And that's the way we've been. I can't become great in the kingdom because somebody has appointed me to something or somebody's given me a job with a big church maybe or some kind of... That doesn't make me great. If I'm going to be great in the kingdom, the more I become like the King, the greater I'm going to be. And that just means the more poor in spirit I am, the more compassionate and capable of being touched with needs of others and my own sin, the more I am weak, the more hunger and thirsty I am for righteousness, the more merciful I am, the more pure in heart, the more of a peacemaker I am, and the more even I'm persecuted. The greater I'm going to be in the kingdom. That's what Jesus was saying. And that was kind of shocking, I'm sure, to those who heard him. But that's exactly what he was saying. So this objection, I can't imagine a person with all these qualities. That's the reason we have the story of Jesus. He is the perfect example of every one of them. But somebody else says, these are just not humanly possible. I'm a little inclined to agree with that. A person just trying to be these things on his own, I'm not sure could be. But those who are in the kingdom are partakers of the divine nature. God helps us to be these things. And the very thought that our sins have been forgiven and we've been given a new start is enough to cause us to be more diligent and to try harder than the person who hasn't been given that new start. Somebody said, but these qualities are not natural. Of course they're not natural. If they were natural, everybody would be practicing them. They are qualities of individuals who have taken on a new nature and have repented of their past sin and have come, as Paul said, to let Jesus live in them. And the argument that everybody does something else, or this is just, that's no argument at all for the Christian. That may be for the person of the world, but it's no argument for the Christian because the Christian is not a man governed by nature. He's governed by the Spirit of God as the Spirit works through His Spirit through the teaching of the Word of God. It's not natural. It's spiritual. And the Christian is a spiritual man. But why would anybody like this be persecuted? It's just hard to imagine anybody like, well, that would be the most wonderful person you could possibly have in a community, be the most wonderful person you could have in a church, be the most wonderful person you could have in a school or in an office or anywhere. The world doesn't treat people who are different very well. The world just doesn't have much room for any difference. It persecutes those who are different. I suspect some of you have experienced that. You go into a school or you go into an office or you're in a community and everybody else is cursing and you don't. And they begin to say, well, what's the matter with this fellow? Who does he think he is? He thinks he's Mr. Goody-Goody, you know. Or you won't go and take a drink when they go for a drink. Or you won't go out on a party when they're going on a party. And before long, your good qualities, your virtues, have caused you to become the object of ridicule and persecution. That's not surprising. And you're inclined to compromise. That's what Satan has always worked for. Now, you can be a little bit of a Christian. He doesn't care. There are millions of those. There are billions of those who are a little bit of Christians. They got their name on church roll somewhere. They call themselves Christians. And that's okay with Satan. He doesn't mind. But when you are a real Christian, he's upset, and he's going to work every way in the world he can to get you to compromise. He tempted Jesus to compromise. That's what those temptations are all about in Matthew, the 4th chapter, verses 8 through 10. If you're the Son of God, bow down and worship me. I'll give you all these kingdoms of the world. You've come for a kingdom. Here's a kingdom. Jesus had come to establish a kingdom that's made up of people who were poor in spirit and pure in heart and hungry and thirsty for righteousness. If Satan had given him a kingdom, you think that had been the kind of people in it? No way in the world. Jesus didn't even pay any attention to him. Jesus didn't listen to him. No, get behind me, Satan. John 6:15, Jesus is being tempted by Satan to establish a kingdom by feeding people. They were ready to make him king, John 6:15, because he fed 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. You think about a fellow like that following with an army? Logistics is one of the biggest problems you have, trying to feed all these people and keep them going. And he could even heal them when they got shot or whatever happened to them. What kind of an army would that be? But that wasn't the kind of kingdom he came to establish. And he said, you're just wanting the loaves and fishes. You're not interested in me, the bread of life. That's the next day, John 6. He could have established a kingdom of Satan's kind. A kingdom wasn't different, but he came to establish a different kingdom. And even in Luke 19, they're calling him the king when he's entering Jerusalem. Well, were they interested in being persecuted? Were they interested in peacemaking? No. Just a few days later, they were saying crucify him. They were interested in war with the Romans, to drive the Romans out. And Jesus just didn't get involved with that at all. He just went to the temple and left it. Jesus did not succumb, and I think he tempted Paul in the same way in Corinth to work miracles and to speak in eloquent language about Jesus to attract those who didn't really care that much about the gospel. He didn't take it, but he tempts us to do the same. And Jesus warns against it. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth." But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled under the foot of man. One of the things that makes salt salt is that it's different. And if it ceases to be different, if it says, well, I believe I'll be kind of sugary. Who wants sugary salt? We want salty salt. And we'll pay a premium if there was some that wasn't really salty. In fact, that's almost a difficult thing to explain. Salt is not salty. Is not salt at all. And a Christian is not a Christian. Not a Christian at all. No, you've got to maintain that difference or you're worthless. And then he goes on, you're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Don't when they're drinking some champagne, get you some ginger ale that looks just as much like the champagne as possible, and let them see the difference. Let them see the difference. And when they're cursing, don't get just as close as you can to using some vulgar, obscene language. Let them see the purity of your language in contrast. And if they ask you about it, tell them why. The Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians 5:11, "Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but reprove them. Speak out against it." You don't have to do it in a self-righteous kind of way. But don't try to hide the fact that you're different from the world. I've kind of respected the Jews in New York where I live. They just wear these little caps, and they're all over the place. They're all in our neighborhood. They wear these little caps that just say, "I'm a Jew." And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what. I'm a Jew. I want everybody to know it. I'm a Jew. But there was some anti-Semitic influences down in Brooklyn here not long ago. And the rabbi said, "For the time being, it'd be all right just to wear baseball caps." What's that saying? I want to be like everybody else. And I'm afraid that's the way we as Christians are. Instead of letting our flag fly so that everybody knows who we are and what we are, without being self-righteous, just by maintaining that simple difference, being a Christian among those who are not Christians, being pure among those who are not pure, instead of doing that, we get a little uncomfortable. And we try to avoid crossing a line that would really be sin, but still try to cover up the difference that exists between us and the world. May God help us never be ashamed to be a Christian. May He help us always to maintain our salt, whether we're on the tomatoes, or whether we are on the egg, or whether we're in the ice cream, go on and be salty, whether they want it or not. You just be salty because that's what you are. And let your light shine. If they want it, if they don't want it, let your light shine. Doesn't say shine your light. We'll talk about that later. But it says let your light shine. Just maintain that difference. And you'll be a blessing to those around you. And in the long run, it'll be a blessing to you. Well, that's the lesson for tonight. And if there's someone here that is subject to the invitation of the Lord, we'd like to encourage you in obedience to the gospel. If you're poor enough in spirit to be obedient to the Lord, if you hunger and thirsty for righteousness, if you want to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven, Jesus said, except a man be born again, he can't enter the kingdom. Except a man born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. And if we can assist you in that, if you're ready to change your lifestyle, be a true Christian, we'd like to assist you in your obedience. If you let our desire be known as we stand and sing.